Welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith Larman. In this episode, I talk with Andrew S. Barish about his book, Lonesome Roads and Streets of Dreams, Place, Mobility, and Race in Jazz of the 1930s and 40s, published in 2012 by the University of Chicago Press. One of Barish's arguments here is that big band dance jazz of the 1930s and 40s, think of the Benny Goodman Orchestra, provided Americans with models of personal and national self-understanding. These were tough times. The Great Depression, World War II, and an insistent drive toward racial integration resulted in a populace on the move geographically, culturally, and ideologically. Barish suggests that the big band industry of the day created the spaces and places where the nation came to understand this movement. He begins with a discussion of the casino ballroom in the city of Avalon on Santa Catalina Island off the coast of Southern California. Here we find a geographically isolated place with a conservative attitude toward the changing times. They hired only white musicians and bands that played a relatively subdued sweet style of dance jazz to overwhelmingly white audiences. Next comes Charlie Barnett, a white band leader who dared to play hot jazz for both white and black audiences, thus creating new spaces for African-American music and musicians in America. A third focus is upon Duke Ellington and how his work can be seen as part of a narrative that follows African Americans' great migration from the American South to the cities of the North. Specifically, Barish analyzes a 1946 performance of the Deep South Suite at the Chicago Civic Opera House as an example of Ellington's ability to play a part in the geographical movement of black people through music. Barish's final case study is of Charlie Christian, the groundbreaking black guitarist from Oklahoma City who played with the Benny Goodman Orchestra and through constant touring and playing was an embodiment of the movement happening all across the American landscape. All in all, Barish's detailed historical, cultural, and ethnomusicological analysis of these artists and the places they played makes for a convincing argument that to understand music, one must understand the times in which it is made, and one way to understand the times is to understand the music which is made within them. Andrew S. Barish lives in Tampa, Florida, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, Andy, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Why don't we start by having you just tell us a little bit about your biography. Where are you from, etc.?
I was born and grew up outside of Boston in a suburb, Sharon, Massachusetts, and I went to college in New York City and did my graduate work at UCLA in musicology and got my doctorate in 2005 in musicology. I got interested in jazz in high school. I had a really terrific jazz teacher in high school, Bob Sinicrope, and I was taught jazz improvisation classes and became a mentor to a lot of people, some who became professional musicians. And that kind of instilled this desire to play and later to write about jazz. Mm-hmm. And at UCLA, I found a musicology program that was kind of tied together my interest in history and American studies with music and musicology, as that was kind of traditionally understood, and then in a more expansive way at that program, and it allowed me to kind of look at the specificity of music in its larger social, historical, cultural context.
Mm-hmm. Because now you're at the University of South Florida, right?
I'm at the University of South Florida in a kind of interdisciplinary humanities department, the Humanities and Cultural Studies department.
Right, because your book, I mean, you get some pretty detailed musicological analysis, but then you do broaden it quite a bit to sociology and cultural studies, right?
Yeah, I try to do that. I guess I see the book as somewhere between historical, mainly American studies work on American culture at this time in the 1930s and 40s, and musicology. And I think that was very characteristic of the kind of program I went to, which wasn't unique. There were others, but it's still, at the time was still not maybe the dominant mode of scholarship in musicology. And so to look at the main concern, I think, that was imparted to me by my mentors in the program was the idea of music as meaning, sounds as meaning. So I wanted to understand how jazz worked how music works on people, on listeners, on musicians, but then also how in a particular moment, cultural context, how that music has meaning, has real content for people. And so to do that, you have to have some accounting of the musical sounds, as well as a familiarity with kind of larger historical and sociological studies of American life at that time.
So backing up just a little, how is it that you chose this music and this time period for your book?
Mm-hmm. It's funny because when you're learning to play jazz, you're really learning a kind of bebop, post-bebop idiom of small ensemble groups, focused heavily on improvisation and a lot less on reading. Though a lot of people who come to jazz in the United States often do through high school big bands and things like that, which do involve arrangements and reading and maybe less improvisation. And that was sort of my background as a kind of student of jazz as a musician. And what was interesting is when you read the scholarship on jazz, it's so heavily weighted, actually, though that's changed, but on the balance, it's heavily weighted toward early jazz in the 20s and sort of the before it kind of emerges into popular culture, and the swing era. And the swing era becomes pretty canonical in jazz writing, jazz historical writing, and figures such as Duke Ellington loom as central figures. I mean, the Ken Burns series was organized around Armstrong and Ellington. And there was this sort of disjunct, this divide between kind of contemporary jazz practice and the kind of canonical music. And so I became interested in trying to understand this body of music, particularly the swing era, because it was so touted and canonized in jazz scholarship. I wanted to understand more about sort of how it worked. And it led me to kind of investigate it because it's funny. I mean, despite revivals with things like jazz at Lincoln Center, it's still a body of music that you don't hear really in mainstream jazz. And so I was just very curious to try and understand how it was put together, how it worked. And that's what, because it was sort of strange, that strange, but I just wanted to understand more about its kind of aesthetic orientation and sort of how these musicians were creating it and what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And was there anything about the cultural landscape beyond mm-hmm. the music that was interesting you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess in kind of connection with this interest in the music was I've always had a particular interest in the 1930s and the Depression era. And, I've actually taught courses in the 1930s and the 40s, the Depression, the Second World War, a lot, and sort of started to read a lot and watch a lot of movies, and just became kind of really interested in a lot of the kind of intellectual preoccupations of that era and the artistic preoccupations, in visual art and intellectual thought, that there was a development of regionalism and a real focus on place in American life. I was interested in kind of the fantasy culture of the 30s and 40s I was teaching a class that was sort of the 20s into the 30s, and it's a nice class to teach because it's kind of broken by the Great Depression, by the sort of stock market crash, and you have the high living jazz age versus the Great Depression. But the 30s and 40s are actually really interesting in that the debates about regionalism, but also national identity, which becomes especially important during the war and trying to mobilize for the war effort. It kind of grew in tandem, but I did have a much broader interest in kind of looking at the era. And I think one of the crystallizing moments for the project, I think, both musically and in a broader cultural sense, was the essays that Warren Sussman wrote, I think in the 1980s. They're real classics of American studies. And he wrote some famous essays. One was called The Culture of Commitment. And they're extraordinary essays in the kind of breadth of material that Sussman covers, Mickey Mouse, board games, anthropological studies, Hollywood film, you know, intellectual work at the time, and that became the kind of model I was sort of aspiring to. Though focusing on music, I thought, you know, can I bring lots and lots of stuff in to kind of contextualize this music and kind of understand it in a new way?
So, theoretically, your book focuses on the ideas of place and space and geography and movement.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, please.
Yeah. So with this interest in this body of music from this era and these kind of larger cultural texts of the era, you know, well, Sussman in particular kind of was good at kind of picking out themes or patterns that seemed to shape very different kinds of activities, you know, card games and movies and things like that. As I got interested in this period of music and this time period and started reading around in various kind of primary texts and secondary literature, I did notice a real concern with place, with this idea of what was America at this in a time where, you know, by the 30s, automobiles are just a kind of fact of American life. During the Depression, there are many stories of people not going without food, but not giving up their automobile, or at least when confronted with that choice. And it seemed like there were this kind of centrifugal forces of the era kind of drawing Americans together through a kind of new mass culture, facilitated by modern developments like automobiles and road building and particularly radio and film. And it just seemed to kind of pop up again and again in a lot of writing. In African-American cultural texts, there was a lot of writing was focused on what Farrah Jasmine Griffin called a migration narrative. And you start to see that a lot where Black musicians of the era are, and I write about this, that Ellington in particular was... He often wrote pieces kind of explicitly themed about the South or titled about the South. And there was a sense of kind of wrestling with that migratory move. This is after the Great Migration, but still there's the flow is definitely from the South to the North. And so I started to see this kind of preoccupation with place. And kind of a corollary to that was movement, because if you were moving, you weren't kind of in place anywhere or rooted. And of course, in kind of the larger society and white society, there was regionalist painters and a kind of tension between, the documentary photography of the era is very much about sort of capturing not only the kind of struggles of Americans during the Depression, all those Farm Security Administration photos, but you know, it's part of kind of a larger project to sort of document American life. And there's a kind of folk music revival at the time, and so like everywhere I looked, there seemed to be this kind of preoccupation with trying to understand what this country was. You know, was it a bunch of just regions, you know, kind of loosely stuck together through a federal government and a national mass culture, or was there kind of some more unifying cultural forces kind of tying Americans together? So it seemed like a logical thing to do to see, well, did big band dance music, which was not the only but was a dominant form of popular music at the time, did that similarly express this kind of this questioning or this concern with place and American, the notion of what American place was, and how did mobility and the increasing mobility people affect or change or challenge existing ideas of what America as a place was.
Mm-hmm. And you've already kind of mentioned it, but how does race play into this story of place and space? I mean, it's part of the title of your book, the subtitle.
Yeah. I started off thinking in kind of general space and place terms and reading first theoretical literature and trying to find the various kind of manifestations of this concern in various cultural texts and in particular in music. But of course, when you're talking about jazz, it's virtually impossible to, and you know, frankly, undesirable or to not deal with race in a substantive way. It just doesn't make sense. And At the largest level, all this discussion and concern of replacing mobility is kind of overlaid on a long-standing division in American society along racial terms, and most strongly around white and black in those terms. The cultural preoccupation with place and space during this era was kind of overlaid on this American ideology of race that was primarily structured around a white-black binary. And segregation is kind of the most obvious example of that, where space is literally carved out and divided between white and black. And of course, whenever you're writing about jazz, it is a complicated music with a complicated history that is deeply entwined between whites and blacks, Southerners and Northerners. So it's kind of impossible not to deal with this. And the more I got into this, the more it seemed like the argument I'm making was not simply that this music was representing or trying to come to terms with place and movement in this era, but that it was simultaneously a wrestling with race and the kind of distribution of people in the United States and what that meant. And of course, mobility in cars made things fluid and kind of undermined or could possibly undermine segregation or cause backlashes against it. And of course, in the North, where there wasn't necessarily legal segregation, there were kind of structural inequalities which kept whites and blacks apart. And so they became a pair. It was impossible to talk about music as a representation or experience of American place without talking it as having a racial component, that you are occupying a white or a black space. Because that was largely how, it seems to me, how people at the time understood it.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, then your book is organized around four core chapters, and each chapter covers a certain band, artist, musician, and a few places as well. So let's start with chapter one, and you write about the casino ballroom on Santa Catalina Island. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, that started as a trip. I'd been to Catalina Island many years ago, and the small island off the coast of Southern California near Los Angeles and Long Beach, and it was, I think, about a two-hour ferry ride. And today it's a major tourist attraction, though it's kind of some very well-heeled Southern Californians own land there and kind of vacation there. But it's still built around tourism, but it was nothing like it was in the kind of early 20th century. And when I went to visit, it has a cute little downtown and take tours of the island, and kind of the centerpiece of the experience of the island is this massive ballroom movie theater called the Casino Ballroom. And the Wrigley family developed the island in the 1920s after they bought it from some previous owners, I think railroad tycoons, if I remember. And the Wrigley Empire around chewing gum, and based in Chicago, and William Wrigley and then his son Philip Wrigley took Catalina and kind of transformed into this kind of middle class resort, or at least that was, you know, they wanted it to be affordable and a place where you could go and leave the hustle and bustle of the city and see nature and sit at the beach. And they also wanted a kind of entertainment venue. And so in the late 20s, William Wrigley had built this massive complex. It's circular. It's very dramatic. It sits out on this point that looks out over the ocean. About three quarters of it, you can see the ocean. And as the ferries come in, it's like one of the first things you see on the island. On the first floor, they built a movie theater. And on the second, there's a bunch of very long ramps that go up to the second floor. They built a really pretty gorgeous ballroom, and with these windows overlooking the ocean. And so when you go to Catalina today, even they give tours of this, and it's a really beautiful building. It's a kind of really nice example of Art Deco architecture. It has these beautiful kind of murals on the side. these mosaics. And so I was interested in jazz, and it was a big band ballroom, and they, and you take a tour and they tell you all about the bands that played there. And they say, on the tour, it's often like, well, Benny Goodman played here, and Kay Kaiser. And okay. So at the time I was like, well, all right, Benny Goodman, I know. And Kay Kaiser, I vaguely know, kind of a sweet band leader, you know, not part of the kind of jazz canon. And then you go downstairs and there's a little museum, and it tells you about the island and the development casino. And there's a kind of a group of pictures of the bands that played there. And what's really interesting is they kind of, the tour guides would sort of talk about the venue as a major swing era venue, but only mention Benny Goodman. It was like, well, where's everyone else? I mean, you know, the Jimmy Dorseys, the Duke Ellingtons, you know, there's, you know, hundreds, 300 plus name bands in the country. And when you look through those photos, until you get to the 1960s, you really don't see, in fact, you don't see any black bands at all. And in addition, what you don't see are any bands that are familiar names, really. Jan Garber, Dick Juergens, Freddie Martin, Kay Kaiser. I mean, Kay Kaiser is probably the best known, but often not by jazz people. So it was, you know, so that chapter grew out of this particular experience. And so what kind of venue was this? Who was playing this venue? And this seemed really a kind of window into an aspect of the dance band culture in American life at this time that was really not covered very well in existing scholarship, either from jazz or American studies. And the more I got into this, what became clear to me is that this was a very particular kind of swing venue, and that there were others like this around the country, that it catered to a almost exclusively white audience, largely middle class, though it's hard to determine who exactly went there, and that they featured a particular kind of strand of big band dance music that was understood at the time as sweet, which was basically a kind of rhythmically less aggressive, melodically heavy, very kind of based in Tin Pan Alley ballads and songs, though not exclusively, versus hot music, which was associated with black bands, which featured faster tempos, more elaborate arrangements, more improvisation. And so this sweet band music was the music of choice for this venue. And that's odd when you step back, because venues, even in places you would not think would want it, would feature mixes of hot and sweet. And the hot bands were often black bands, and the sweet bands were often white. But if you look at venues all throughout the American South and the West, it was common, even in the most segregated parts of the South, to have a variety of music, and especially to have black bands one week and white bands the next. Now, the patrons would be segregated, but the idea of having blacks entertaining whites was not a problem at all. So it was really striking that the casino ballroom featured white bands playing this particular kind of sweet jazz. For basically most of the 30s, they start incorporating more pop bands, and Benny Goodman is the kind of one of the first of that kind that they invite. And it's not until 1941 that he's there. Basically at the kind of the end of the height of the casino ballroom, because by World War II, that ballroom is not really being used anymore, and the island's converted to kind of wartime mobilization. And so that's what motivated the chapter, was it just became this question of why these sweet bands, why only white bands? Because black bands could also play sweet. Bands were, as I write, were, you know, artistic entities, but commercial entities, and they would play music that patrons wanted. And there are many stories of this, of Andy Kirk or even Duke Ellington. Andy Kirk was a famous black band leader, playing waltzes or polkas if that's what the community they wanted. So that's what kind of spurred the chapter and led me to kind of try to answer that. And ultimately what I came up with was this idea that the Wrigleys and the Santa Catalina Island Company, which is the kind of corporation that owned the island and ran the islands, that the Wrigley vision of the island required that even the sounds that people heard be part of a kind of overall experience. And that experience was one of a kind of nostalgic modernism, kind of sense that the island had everything you wanted of modern American life, but without kind of the complicated or maybe perhaps unpleasant aspects of intense developments of modern life and all this mobility and movement that could bring, say, unwanted people to your venue, mainly Blacks, but certainly in Southern California, Mexican-Americans, Asian-Americans as well. So it became pretty clear that the music was part of this kind of tourist and ecological project to make a particular kind of white middle-class resort that was both modern and convenient, but yet kind of tried to force or kind of push away some of the more democratizing or pluralizing elements of American life at that time. At least that's what I argue for. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I don't know. I worked a lot at the archive there. They actually have quite a lot of good material, and they were very nice and very receptive to me. And I think I sent them. It was a journal article first and then kind of revised for the end. I never asked them to kind of change the tour or anything, but it was just it was a really interesting project, and it kind of opened a whole new door into this era that really ends up helping you bridge kind of the jazz writing that has developed around swing era jazz and the American studies writing, because this was a music created actually kind of together with and in response to hot jazz. So the sweet jazz, the music at the casino ballroom is kind of like, it is dance band jazz. There's no doubt about it. These bands look the same. Say the Duke Ellington Orchestra or the Jimmy Lunsford Band, another Black band, looked like the Jan Garber Band. I mean, they dressed in sharp suits. They both were horn-based bands that they employed the same instruments, they often used the same repertory of songs, and that there were specific kind of musical dimensions in terms of arrangement, in terms of approaches to rhythm, and approaches to improvisation and to the presentation of melody that kind of mark them and separate them out. So even if you didn't have to say that this is, say, a white venue, the music could kind of say that for you in a lot of ways, or at least that's what I posit the Wrigleys kind of were thinking, or I can't know that, but that was the effect of their policies, I think.
Mm-hmm. So then on to chapter two, where you focus on Charlie Barnett as an artist and the Meadowbrook Inn as a place. Talk about them, please.
As I was doing the book, it became clear to me, or this through the editorial process, this was made clear that the first chapter is very much about this place, and I focus a lot on Jan Garber, particular band, his interesting history, and his history is interesting because he went kind of hot and sweet and hot and sweet. He kind of went back and forth depending on the kind of commercial winds of the time. So it was kind of focused a lot on this place through this particular artist. And then the second chapter, Charlie Barnett, was very much about Barnett, but it became a lot about another venue, the Meadowbrook Inn, which ends up being a kind of counterpoint to the casino ballroom. And in some ways, the casino ballroom in its scale, its scope, and even in the kind of bands that play there is actually somewhat unusual. The Meadowbrook Inn is much more typical dance venue. But it has certain elements that are unusual as well. And it reflects a kind of very different concerns. That's a venue that was created by this guy, Frank Daly, in the late 20s. He was a musician and he was with a band and it didn't quite work out. And I guess him or his band, they bought this, this building, this structure, and made it a dance hall. And that dance hall was in off the Pompton Turnpike in New Jersey, and it's just 5 to 10 miles from Manhattan, from the kind of hothouse of the swing era of jazz at the time. And so the venue was very close to Manhattan, but separated and clearly suburban. And to get in a car, as far as I can tell, you really couldn't take a train. I mean, you took a train, you'd still have to take a car. So it wasn't rural, it was suburban. And it was very close to New York. So it attracted many of the biggest name bands in very differently than the Casino Ballroom, who had big names, but of this very particular kind of sweet kind. But the Meadowbrook Ballroom had, you know, just everyone, and became a major venue for the Dorseys, for Glenn Miller early on. Black bands played there, white bands played there. When I looked into it, it turns out the venue did have segregated policies in terms of who could attend. It was, from what I could tell, largely a white venue. I found an article of reminiscences from someone from an African-American from Newark talking about his high school prom was there, and he couldn't go because it was a whites-only venue. And so it had elements of I mean, it was segregated, at least from what I can tell, most of the time. But it featured white and black bands. It featured hot and sweet bands, and mainly because of its proximity to New York. But it also had a radio control booth that could remotely broadcast. And the Casino Ballroom had this, too. It was put in a little later. And that helped the Casino Ballroom achieve kind of national exposure. But the Meadowbrook was I think, arguably the better known venue. And of course, having a radio link was very attractive for any band because these were live radio remotes. Sometimes they were recorded. They were often broadcast live and transmitted across the country. And when people heard you, that could get you more gigs and get you on the road. And at the time, it was nice for a traveling band to spend a long time in a single venue, say a week at the Meadowbrook Inn or a hotel in New York or even the Casino Ballroom. But the real money was in these one-nighters, actually. And that created actually a kind of brutal schedule. So anyways, so there's this venue, the Meadowbrook Inn. It has some similarities to the Casino Ballroom, but represents, I think, ultimately a very different kind of ballroom experience in the music culture at the time. And it just seemed like an interesting counterpoint. But then, of course, I found about the Meadowbrook Inn because of this Charlie Barnett tune called Pompton Turnpike. And I was interested in Barnett. Barnett's an extraordinarily colorful character by swing era standards. He had multiple marriages. He had to publish music under pseudonyms so he couldn't be sued for alimony. He was a big practical joker. He recounts in his autobiography, which is very funny and entertaining, that they did practical jokes. They drank a lot. They did drugs. There's talk of prostitution. I mean, it's kind of like a rock and roll biography of the swing. It's fun. And it's funny, though, at the end, Barnett kind of has a digression where he talks about how awful he thinks pop music is and rock and roll. It's kind of funny. Paper in there somewhere. And so Barnett was this incredibly character that hasn't really been written about. And his music is interesting because he was celebrated as kind of among the hottest, or often considered the hottest, of the white bands, someone who explicitly embraced black vernacular practice, the music that sounded black. But even more than that, Barnett's kind of explicitly embraced the black community in a way that artists like Benny Goodman, for all his work integrating bands at the time, didn't. Goodman has been written about a lot, and he was somewhat aloof and distant and kind of very serious guy, and Barnett was the kind of total opposite. And the band had a kind of looser sound. He started hiring black musicians very early. I don't think he fully integrated that band till the 40s, which is after Goodman, but he had moments of integrated times where his band was integrated before Benny Goodman, so he is in a sense a pioneer in that way. And his whole career seemed to be about movement and mobility, both musically and geographically. And so I came across this tune, the Pompton Turnpike, and I investigated, you know, so what, like singing, like naming a song after a highway in New Jersey just seemed, it just doesn't seem that glamorous, but it seemed to me that it was a relatively new road at the time. It was a suburban experience. It was something removed from Manhattan. And that I think it did have a sense at the time, you know, calling something the Pompton Turnpike of movement, of the open road, of, you know, I mean, it's not like traveling the highways out west or something like that. But it definitely had that kind of meaning, I think, that was sort of attached to it. But it still struck me as odd. So that got me into both Barnett as a musician, but also into the Pompton Turnpike. And of course, you once you read about that, you realize that it's called the Pompton Turnpike. Barnett called the tune Pompton Turnpike because it was an ode to the Meadowbrook Inn. And therefore, then I had this connection between this artist, this song, this venue, and this kind of suburban place that was kind of accessible through automobiles, and that it seemed to represent something new, something special. And then I started to see the idea of mobility and movement as a kind of organizing metaphor for understanding Barnett's life. He embraced the jazz life from very early and loved to travel. And he moved both literally across the country, but through his music, it became increasingly moved toward hot music, and he hired black musicians. He was voted. He came close to becoming an honorary mayor of Harlem. He also played the kind of black circuit of theaters, the Toba Circuit, the theater of black owners, a theater owners. I can't remember the exact, but the Toba Circuit was black theaters throughout the country, largely in the North. And he played that circuit of theaters, a theater owner booking association, that's what it was. And he played that circuit. So he seemed like a special case and like very different than Jan Garber. That's sort of how that chapter kind of came about. And it let me talk about another venue with a kind of a different artist with a different set of priorities, but both combining a kind of music and place in the context of the 30s and modernization at the time.
Chapter three, then, you focus on Duke Ellington and lots of movement and migration. And you specifically focus, when it comes to place, I guess, on a specific performance, the 1946 Chicago Civic Opera House performance, and even some movements within that performance. So tell us about Duke Ellington, please.
Yeah, so the next two chapters, the Ellington and Christian chapters, are really kind of focused on movement and less about particular places, though there is a kind of central place in the Ellington chapter, and that's the Chicago Civic Opera House and a concert they did in 1946. And I chose that concert for a variety of reasons. I kind of discovered it because it was one of the few concerts that this French, this Parisian gypsy guitarist, Django Reinhardt, came to the United States and toured with Ellington. And that's the only recorded encounter of Django Reinhardt and Ellington. And I've written about that elsewhere. And the more I looked at the concert, the more sort of interesting it became as a kind of symbol or example of a variety of things about Ellington at that time. The shift Ellington's band took from playing, say, nightclubs like the Cotton Club in the late 20s and early 30s to dance halls to theaters. And he was moving increasingly into theaters. And that trend would kind of continue through the 50s as jazz took on more of an aura of art music and less kind of popular music. And of course, you look at Ellington's catalog, and even more so than these other musicians, there was a very clear and explicit preoccupation with place. And these are largely reflected in the titles of the pieces. And titles can be tricky because in instrumental pieces without lyrics, there's anecdotes and lots of evidence that jazz musicians often name things for arbitrary reasons or silly reasons. Regardless of that, titles are always at least partly constitutive of meaning. So you can listen to a song but you're always going to know the title, and that title is always going to shape your reception of that song. And so I believe that the connection, whether it's intentional by the artist or not, is valuable. It has meaning, interpretive meaning, to understanding the tune. But with Ellington, though, it goes even further, because Ellington has written a lot. He spoke a lot of spoken introductions. He did a lot of interviews. He wrote his own autobiography. So the preoccupation with place is actually quite explicit with him. It's not something that takes a lot of analysis. I mean, he has music that talks a lot about Harlem, and he has music that talks a lot about the South. His music is a kind of atlas, a geography of places and place experiences. And the Chicago concert kind of embodied a lot of those trends. You could kind of see a lot of the music. And the piece that drew me in particular was the Deep South Suite, which was, as he moved into theaters, he was shifting the kinds of musical styles, the kind of musical works that they were playing. And so they would play all their 3-minute dance numbers or their records, their famous records, often in medleys. And he started featuring these larger and more ambitious works. 1943's Black, Brown, and Beige is perhaps the most famous. And throughout the 40s, he did these Carnegie Hall, these annual Carnegie Hall concerts, where he featured these kind of ambitious works. Most of them were becoming suites, so kind of 3 or 4 movement works with that weren't necessarily like integrated musically, but were thematically connected. And the Deep South Suite was among these. And it was interesting because it was about the Deep South. And it not only were the titles of the works, the Deep South Suite, and then the first movement was Magnolias Dripping with Molasses, and then a second movement called Hearsay, and the third movement was When I Thought No One Was Looking, I think, and the final movement was Happy-Go-Lucky. And the middle two movements are kind of oblique. But the third movement was about a train, and it sounds like a train. It was one of these Ellington train pieces. But along with the titles, and the title was Suite, of course, Ellington had kind of written program notes, or at least spoken them. And there's a V-disc recording, the Deep South Suite, with, I think, Leonard Feather speaking the Ellington story, these kind of liner notes. And so it's attracted a lot of attention by Ellington scholars because it is such a kind of detailed, musical portrait of the South. And a lot of the focus on the Deep South Suite was whether this was a political or ironic commentary in the South. And certainly if you listen to Ellington's work, if you read his program in its various forms, as Leonard Feather reads it, or in his he includes it in his autobiography in the 1970s. And it's very interesting because he provides a sort of literary text that goes with the music, and it sort of begs to be read together. And traditionally, the Deep South Suite was read as a critique of the South, naturally for its segregation, the violence, the lynchings, all those things. But as I got into it and you kind of situate it among these other place themes, you realize that the Deep South Suite, at least to me it seemed, was much more ambivalent and ambiguous, and that the irony is easier to identify through the words than the music. And the music takes you through a range of emotions, a kind of trajectory emotional trajectory, a cognitive trajectory of various kinds of moods and feelings and tempos. And it just seemed like to call the piece ironic or critical was just very simplistic. And it seemed to me the piece embodied a much more contradictory statement about the South. And of course, that tied into a much broader preoccupation of cultural texts that engaged with the South, in particular in the context of a migration narrative. So you have, for instance, Richard Wright's Native Son is a really brutal, kind of devastating depiction of the urban Black experience in the North. And Zora Neale Hurston wrote of Mules and Men, a kind of oral history of collection of folk stories that's really affectionate and very powerful in its own way about the South. So the feelings among these African-American artists and intellectuals and writers, it was far more ambivalent. And I think that piece captures that ambivalence very well. In addition, we tend to hear Ellington's pieces as Ellington, as this sort of statement of Ellington. And of course it wasn't. It was a band of many people, and it was a complex organism, and there's many voices. And within that Deep South suite, we hear solo voices, lots of solo voices, and they are often saying things musically that kind of go with the suite, but also are at odds with the suite. So it's interesting that there are a few direct references or kind of musical signs or sort of semiotics of the South in that piece. And they're very few, and they're really not in the parts that Ellington wrote. They're in the parts that are improvised, like Lawrence Brown's trombone solo, where he quotes Old Folks at Home, the Stephen Foster minstrel tune. And there's Jimmy Hamilton's clarinet references, When the Saints Go Marching In. And so the chapter, Let Me Explore a Place, the Ellington Band is the sort of nomadic place-creating phenomenon, and also as a complicated kind of symbol of the Black experience at that time, and it's kind of coping with migration and movement. And what a perfect example to express that then through a band that was almost totally nomadic, that just did nothing but move and travel.
And then there's chapter four, the fourth of your core chapters, and this deals with the guitarist Charlie Christian. And this seems, as you just mentioned, this seems to be another kind of nomadic theme in that chapter.
Yeah. So Charlie Christian is this greatly celebrated jazz guitarist. He's important. He's often celebrated as this kind of link between swing era jazz and bebop, and that he started improvising in ways that seemed, that we look back now as proto bebop, as these long, linear, chromatically inflected solo lines that were rhythmically adventurous, melodically adventurous, harmonically adventurous. And Christian's, I'm a jazz drummer and a guitarist, and I kind of took up the guitar later. And Christian is this really important figure. And the first time I heard it, the music just was totally captivating. He has a kind of energy and a drive, and by all accounts, he played loud by the time period. He was one of the earliest electric guitarists, not the first, but and his sound is really striking. It's got a slight kind of distorted edge to it, just a little, and it's just totally gripping, and it was fascinating, and it's fascinated a lot of people, and very, very influential. And so I was interested in Christian. And of course, the other component to his influence or to the story of Charlie Christian is this kind of rags to riches, this local Oklahoma City musician who becomes picked up by Benny Goodman, the biggest swing era big band, and made into a star like virtually overnight. And the story of Christian's discovery is like a very kind of classic, kind of archetypical American kind of entertainment story, where this kind of unknown talent is sort of discovered and rises to national prominence. And as I looked into the story, it seemed to become as much about Christian's, his obvious talent and abilities. And he's really discovered by John Hammond, music producer, critic, writer, and introduced to Goodman. But Christian's story is also this interesting regional to national story. And that seemed to reflect all these other concerns that I had developed about place and movement during the era. And Christian really crystallized this kind of underlying social development that was often not talked about when people talk about Christian, and that was this tension between the regional and the national. And Susan Douglas, the radio historian, has a great essay about radio from the 30s and comedy programs. She has this interesting part about Amos and Andy, how that was essentially a blackface skit, but it was also embodied sort of regional distinctiveness, a particular way of talking that was very specific to say the South. And so Christian's music, his life experiences seem to tap into the very same cultural phenomenon. There seemed to be this the similar phenomenon of a move from the region to the nation, or this tension between the local and the increasingly centralized, nationalized culture of America during the Depression and the war. And so in the chapter, I trace Christian's his musical development, his musical style, and kind of map that on to this larger story of the move from the region to the nation. And Christian's musical style has certain characteristics about it that are very consistent and have to do with the kind of his approach to different parts of kind of conventional jazz tunes. So, for instance, in most jazz tunes from the swing era, you're either playing a blues, a 12-bar blues, or a 32-bar AABA Tin Pan Alley form. And in the Tin Pan Alley forms, Christian played very bluesy over the A sections and then developed this really vibrant, linear, chromatic, long melodies through the bridge sections. And the bridge sections often featured more harmonic complexity, key changes, or sort of dominant seven chords that sort of follow one another. And it was like an obstacle course. So it seemed to me Christian's style, it's the very core of his playing, the bones of his formal approach to music, also seemed to echo the tensions of local culture, say blues culture in Oklahoma City, and a kind of growing national jazz language that was more chromatic, that was eventually moving toward bebop.
So then you wrap up the book in your conclusion with a story about Jimmy Lunsford, and you link this to the increasingly popular transportation of airline flight. So conclude our interview with this, please.
So the final chapter, I kind of developed in an odd way. I was so focused on automobiles and trains and that kind of movement and migrations of people. And then, of course, as this happens, sort of listening to tunes, you come across ones that kind of jump out at you. And Jimmy Lunsford's music, and this tune, Stratosphere in particular, I found on an anthology of big band jazz, a very good one that Gunther Schuller and Martin Williams put together. It's a little hard to find. And the tune was striking both musically and the title was very evocative. And so I wanted to kind of flesh that out. And as I kind of dug into the tune and started thinking about it and reading about it and reading about Jimmy Lunsford, I suddenly realized I had a lot of connections to what had come before in the book. And so the connections kind of unfold like this. So one point of the book that I wanted to make was that despite the division of the industry into white and black and hot and sweet, the interconnections among musicians were pretty profound. For instance, Charlie Barnett gets started with Jan Garber's discarded arrangements of Tin Pan Alley tunes. And Jan Garber records a version of Avalon, a song that Al Jolson made famous in 1920. And there are lots of recordings of Avalon. And I found a Lunsford recording of Avalon, which I use to kind of compare the Garber recording in the Avalon chapter. And and Lunsford's music seemed to be not something talked about that much. It was very interesting, very compelling music. And his biography becomes really interesting. He was, along with Ellington, among the top, say, two or three or five black bands in the country. He had a very particular style, a very identifiable rhythmic signature, this kind of Lunsford two-beat that was somewhat at odds with the dominant kind of strong 4-4 swing feel that had come to characterize most of swing or dance band music, both white and black. And of course, Lunsford was obsessed with airplanes. I thought this is perfect. You know, it all kind of, all the pieces sort of fit together. And that led me to kind of explore Lunsford's fascination with airplanes in a larger context of African-American interest in airplanes and air flight, and into a kind of, through a really terrific Ralph Ellison story called Flying Home, which was great because that was the name of the Christian tunes that I analyzed the most in the Christian chapter. That Ellison story is about a pilot training during, I think, World War II, and he crashes, and he sort of crashes back in time on a sort of plantation-like part of the South, and he's a modern African-American, he's sort of thrust back into the past. And through the course of the story, you get told this myth of the flying African, a kind of folklore that had been told, carried with slaves and sort of developed in the New World. And it basically involved this idea of a mythical or shamanistic figure kind of talking, allowing blacks to fly back to Africa. And that was also nice. And so I could kind of situate Lunsford's interest in flying both with technology and modernism of the 30s, but with African-American history, and to see that song Stratosphere as a kind of reflection of this, of what flight meant to perhaps Lunsford and to the black community, and then and what flight meant to Americans at large, because flight represented a kind of a future-oriented, a progressive vision, a kind of 1939 World's Fair optimism about technological development and mobility and movement to kind of free Americans from existing racial structures and racism. And so Lunsford ended up being an excellent way to kind of tie all the themes of the books together and kind of look toward the future beyond the 30s and 40s.
Fabulous. Thanks for being on our show, Andy. And, you know, if nothing else, I mean, there's lots of great stuff in your book. If nothing else, though, I think it shows how well, or you do a great job of showing how we can use music, which is oftentimes considered kind of trivial, and explore larger cultural themes with it. What are you up to now? Do you have any projects you're working on?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you say that, because that, I think that's a good statement of what I think I'm, at least I think I'm trying to do, and that's the idea of music as a source of historical information. And I was actually studied history as an undergrad and came to music, like academic music study, musicology, music theory, kind of late, and I've always been interested. Well, I was always frustrated by a lot of American history and American studies with how vague discussions of music became. And because I had played some music and had some familiarity, it seemed to me that you were missing something. I mean, we go to music for a lot of reasons, primary being the sounds, the actual sounds that we hear, the vibrating air that enters our ear, that affects our minds and our bodies. And that became really important to me. And I think my next project, it's kind of developing out of the Avalon chapter. I got interested in sort of Timpan Alley from the 30s and 40s. A very canonical topic in the study of American popular music. It's the golden age of American song. But the sweep band stuff I did made me interested in how vast the Timpan Alley catalog was and how diverse it was in terms of musical style, and that vast amounts of it are just not heard or studied about or talked about. And so I really want to get into a lot of that, particularly tunes that are often dismissed as ballads or sentimental or novelty tunes, as sources of historical information, new windows into this time period in American life. And so that's kind of where I'm headed.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Andy, and good luck in your future work.
You've been listening to a conversation with Andrew S. Barish about his book, Lonesome Roads and Streets of Dreams: Place, Mobility, and Race in Jazz in the 1930s and 40s, published by the University of Chicago in 2012. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Marmon. Thanks for listening.